My name's Edith. I'm an alcoholic. I carry these around. People make a lot of fun of me, but I don't care. You know, you got friends like Doug back there. People know you're a reprobate. Where I come from in Omaha, we'll often say, thanks to a loving God, Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsorship both ways, a lot of church basements. My husband's here with me. He's a deacon, but they still don't like me in the upper floor of churches. A lot of church basements. I hadn't had a drink since the first day of June of 1987, and for that I'm very grateful. Hey. So this is, I think, a precursor to your roundup, as I gathered. And thank you, Miss Shires, and your old man, and thank you, Katie. I've been given a lot of good hospitality here, and we're so glad that y'all are going to keep us up. We're staying for 2 weeks at a hotel not too far from here. I always appreciate people who are in service. And, you know, in AA, we talk about unity, just like Miss Shires said, or the lady announcing things, Meredith. And I never understood what that word really meant. When I was drinking and doing a little dope, things were always segregated. I was apart from. I didn't really get being integrated. I wasn't with you. I wasn't with anybody. And I was alone, just like the book talks about. And there's a really sweet kind of idea of unity that Bob, you know, Bill's a great salesman. Bob had a little more humility. Richard and I just went to Akron not too many months ago and went to Bob's house. It's very modest. And you could imagine how many people were up in Smitty's bedroom getting shook out, you know, and they'd feed them, as you know, probably K-Rose syrup, vitamin B, and stewed tomatoes. That was sort of, and then they started giving them a paralytic. You know, they really, these guys were just experiments. But some of them would come out and stay sober. Of course, Dobson being that, you know, that third guy. But this is what Bob said his last talk publicly. So it was probably trying to stay here with your microphone, but so this was probably about 1950, and this, I think, sums up what we're talking about, getting in unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, becoming a part of something greater than us, because alone we're going to fail. We come to know that if you've ever had a surrender and conceded to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. Bob says, "Seems to me you folks are making heavy going. I'm not to be taken so seriously as all that. I was only the first link in that chain of providential circumstances, which is called Alcoholics Anonymous. By grace and good fortune, my link did not break, though my faults and my failures often might have brought on that unhappy result. I was just another alcoholic trying to get along under the grace of God. Forget me and go, you, and do likewise. Add your own link to our chain. With God's help, you will forge that chain well and truly." It was in this manner, if not in these exact words, that Bob did actually estimate himself and counsel all of us. And I love that idea, because now I'm here, you're with me, and we're all in a chain link fence. If you ever been to an international convention, you probably have held hands with 55,000 alcoholics at one point in time while that gig was going on one time in your fair city. Maybe that was 15, right? Yeah. So I believe that if you could statistically monitor that, there'd probably be a calibration of energy that's pretty substantial. And that's what we're talking about. We're in unity. We're in a chain link fence. And if you've got that in front of you, behind you, to the side of you, you're in a protective mantle that's probably going to carry you no matter what comes. You know, my oldest and dearest friend in Omaha, son overdosed, and he's dead. And so we're on a long vigil from November 18th till about the 27th. He was on life support. And I really knew little of how to comfort my friend. And what I did know was that no matter what, there was going to be a continuing chain link fence that we would all remain in, whether Max was in it or he was on the other side of things. And when we, you know, were at that kind of final day, I knew that was going to be a humbling experience, because what I kept praying for naturally as an alcoholic, and we prayed a lot together in community because there were a lot of people there who were sober. But what I kept praying for is give him another swing, you know, give him another swing. I overdosed a number of times and resuscitated. Thank you. There's a guy back there who's either an EMT or a chronic problem. Anyway. So I was hopeful for the second chance. It didn't work out that way. But I've been, you know, when I speak lately, I've been remembering Max, because that's a... he's someone who's 20 years in the spiritual economy, was, I guess, how it was to be, but it doesn't seem exactly proper from my lens, but does that matter? I don't know. My point in telling you this story is, one, you can survive no matter what the circumstances and not take a drink, and number two, this may be the only time you get to the batter's box, so be mindful of that too. Back in Omaha, we say you're locked up, sobered up, covered up. I've been locked up, I'm sobered up, and I'm really grateful that I'm here with you tonight. Some of my family members are covered up, so I'm grateful. I am a Grapevine subscriber, and I can say, I don't know if you have a Grapevine representative here, but probably, okay, the lady, she's kind of humble, real quiet. You pressing them on the issue, madam? Telling them how few people subscribe? And you're burning a lighter? Okay. Anyway, I can probably say to you, I've been an uninterrupted subscriber to the Grapevine for all of my sobriety. So that's 30 years. So here's a great joke. So I failed to tell them properly, so I read them. Words that are difficult to say when you're drunk: innovative, preliminary, proliferation, cinnamon. Words that are really difficult to say when you're drunk: specificity, anti-constitutionality, passive-aggressive disorder, and for all you Catholics, transubstantiate. Words that are impossible to say when you're drunk: no thanks, I'm married. You're not my type. I'm not interested in fighting you. Thank you, I won't make any more attempts to dance. And I have to be going home because I have to work in the morning. Baby, I never had to go home because I had to work in the morning. I grew up in Alabama, so close to here. I went to Auburn too. I was telling these girls, I'm 58, so I outage a lot of people here, but we used to go to the Limelight when it was new, you know. And I had a job on an assembly line when I was in high school, and we'd go out on the river after school and stay out and drink beer, and then I wouldn't bathe. I had longer hair than I do now. I wouldn't bathe, and then I'd go to work the next morning, of course, late. Good news was I had an incorrigible boss. He was as much trouble as I was. But there are no idea ever in my database that I had a responsibility to be at work on time, that I had a responsibility to have a hairnet on in the assembly line, that I had a responsibility to be of service to all those. We serviced indigent children who were out in parks. We made their lunches. It was a governmental sponsored program, and we'd show up, Winston and I, we had a little kind of a truck and with a bell on it, and we'd have been out all night and have some poorly made lunches and had rang our bell, and then we'd start smoking a joint and let the kids get their own lunch. Anyway, and that's just one job of many that I can tell you about that I was a poor employee. But I grew up on the Tennessee River, so close to you, and I loved it. I could get from my parents' home, my home too, probably on foot, within 9 minutes running to the river. And we had a broken down boat there, and it was pretty nice, I thought. It was called the Tomato. And you know how it is if you're a river person. I could drive that boat before I had a driver's license. And my daddy let us, he allowed us to be unsupervised on that boat. And you couldn't, of course, buy any liquor in Morgan County when I was coming up. What, are you a bootlegger? Anyhow, I did. You did have to go to the bootlegger. There were state stores in surrounding counties, but of course you'd have to have and back then your IDs were on paper. You know, that's the other thing. Yeah, an ID, alteration was a pretty minor job. You just had to find anybody I have hazel eyes, 5'8", 128 pounds, and anyway, there's other people similar. So getting a fake ID, so to speak, was often easy. You were just impersonating someone else. But I spent a lot of time on the river, and I'd ride down to Marvelline's. Marvelline had a trailer, and she was in a small town down the road called Triana. And you'd get out of your boat and go up to the trailer and knock on the door, and I was buying, for you young people, a case of Schlitz for $6. And that's with the premium the bootlegger put on it. And so I knew Marvelline. Marvelline later became the mayor of Triana. There's an old place down there, too. I don't know if any of you ever been there, called the River Club. And that was my kind of place. No floor. People put their guns on the table. And it was as low class as you can get. Wear your bathing suit in. Never had, no closing hours. And that's the kind of places that I like. And they played Hank Williams, not Hank Williams Jr., Hank Williams, So I like those old kind of haunts. But as I was coming up, I had two good parents. They taught me a lot, good deal of important information. We had all that we needed in our household. My daddy had a liquor cabinet up there, and my mama was into it just like me. And he knew about that. So he was, he was mindful of that and kept it kind of locked and tried to supervise what was going on. That was hard to do. It's hard to rein somebody like me in. Because when I started drinking, it took the edge off. And that's what I needed. There's a sharp edge there, and I didn't like it. So I wanted something to take the edge off. It was necessary. It came to be, I figured, I believed, and that's the way I operated. So as I went through high school, I was out in the gravel parking lot before school, and I'd drink, and I'd smoke weed, and then go to school. I was on a member of the National Honor Society. I don't know that I was somebody they'd want to hold out as an exhibit, but the point of that story is I was still making grades that were, fairly exceptional. And for that reason, my father really didn't have a lot of reason to kind of monitor my whereabouts. Later, he came to find plenty of reasons to monitor my whereabouts, but and he had a lot of good ways to do it. But I started getting in trouble, as you might imagine. And as the river progressed, the Coast Guard came to know us, and they'd be at our old boat. We had the worst boathouse, the boathouse that was sinking into the river, dropping back into the. And so they'd show up and say, "Edith, we know what y'all were out there," and they'd ticket what y'all were out there doing, and they'd ticket people on my boat: reckless skiing, reckless driving. So I would get these water-bound tickets. And then when I started driving a car, I started getting arrested and for driving under the influence, of course. What happened back then was, on occasion, these police officers would drive you home. They knew where I lived. They knew my old man, my papa, and so they'd just take you back home. Not always. So when I was up there in Morgan County Jail after a few times, I knew my daddy wasn't going to come and fetch me. And, I knew a few things. Number one, I needed a boyfriend who could sign my bond, who owned property or could sign my bond. Number two, I used to wear Levi's. I had, how Levi's had a watch pocket in them? So some other management techniques, I'd always have the gnaws. And I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I very much respect. But I'd keep two and all and second all in my pockets, because if I started drinking, I'd always drive. And if you tried to get my car keys, I'd fight with you. So I knew if I could ingest something that would slow me down, I might not get in the car. It was a poor idea, of course. A couple of times when, after my plan, I thought it become, was implemented. I remember a friend of mine, Jane, and I driving some just golf carts into the pool. You couldn't steer fast enough to get out of the pool. But anyway, so. If you'd been watching me in a helicopter, you probably would have had the idea that things are going to go poorly soon. I didn't have that idea. I never had a long view. I still would say that often my life has been a series of events based on divine evolution. I'm not a good planner. My sister-in-law decided before she married my brother that they would marry, that she would have this sort of affiliation with a sorority. She would graduate, she would have this degree, and they would have two children. All those things were in the trajectory perfectly, just as she planned. I didn't plan anything. I'm still not much of a planner, which doesn't bother me. But had you been watching, you would have understood that the long view for me was going to be pretty severe. Because I kept getting arrested and things were going poorly. And my old man knew that if you continued to talk to somebody like me, there was not going to be any results because I didn't pay attention. So he had some guys that worked for him, and what they would do is they'd come, and when I'd stay gone for a couple of days, I had a Mercury Marquis for a while. Those are hard to miss, But they're good. They're really good for riding a lot of people around, okay? Had a big, you can put eight people in a Mercury Marquis. Had a big mirror in the back, and then in the trunk you could carry everything you needed for a few weeks because the trunk was huge. And so I had that big car, but my daddy had enough guys that worked for him with tow trucks, because he had a gasoline and oil business. He would tell them, go find Edith's car. Of course, nobody could monitor you back then, thank goodness. I'm so grateful that no one has a film of me from 1978. But my daddy would have those guys go pick up my car. And he told the pawn shop owners, if Edith comes in and brings any silver or grandmother's jewelry, you're to call me. I'll buy it directly from you back. And he told the men that worked for him, you know, Edith's a thief, so I don't want to hear dealing with any cash, because I worked in my father's company while I was in high school. Did you ever have that opportunity? It was called DECA back when I was young, and you'd get out after fourth period to go work for an employer, and then they'd come and interview your employer. And my father said she was absolutely the most abysmal employee that I've ever had. She'll never be rehired. And that's the report he gave me, because I was untrustworthy. So my daddy would tell the banker, if she has a check and it's written on my business, it's forged. She didn't have authority to do that. So he was up in front of this thing, see. He'd been to World War II. He was a veteran. He was a hard guy, a hard-riding guy. And he got it. My father drank every day of his life that I knew him when he wasn't hospitalized. But he didn't have a disease like I do, I don't think. Some people might consider him to be an over-consumer of alcohol. I don't really care what they consider him to be. All I know is he did not have a spiritual malady. Things did not turn out for him like they did for me when he started drinking. And you got Clancy coming to your big show, and Clancy talks about that. You know, there are people who can stop drinking because they have a serious event. One of my partners in my business did that years ago when he was in college. Had some bad outcomes drinking. Quit drinking. Doesn't drink. Didn't go to AA. You know, didn't have to have spiritual help. Didn't have to have a sponsor. Just quit. And then there are people who have medical detachment from alcohol. My father had that a few times, where he would go in and had to have a procedure, but because he was dependent on alcohol physically, he'd have to have a medical detachment. And then those people may or may not stay off of it. And then there's people like us, at least me, a guy like Doug. Okay? And when we start drinking, we don't know what the end's going to look like, do we? And the other thing about that is, this is a disease for me that requires a transformation. It's what Chuck Chamberlain talks about. I must get a new pair of glasses, because if I don't, then I'm going to continue that same idea and that same cycle that I was always in, which is take the edge off, because reality is too big for me to take on. Last week, I was in front of the Supreme Court of the state of Nebraska. Yes, it is unbelievable, but they gave me a license in Nebraska to practice law. But every time that I'm in the Capitol, in the Court of Appeals of the Nebraska Supreme Court, arguing, I do the same thing, the same exact procedure. I go to the women's restroom on the second floor of the Capitol, and I get down on my knees, and I thank God for my sobriety. Because for somebody like me to have the opportunity to be in front of a tribunal for whom I have so much respect, and to know that they are going to pay attention to what I have to say, and to know that I've taken the time to prepare and hopefully can deliver what's expected of me, is only as a result of the grace of God and what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous in practice. So what I'm trying to say is, you've got a design for living here, and it's nowhere else has that come to me. Nowhere else has that been presented to me. You know, my mother and my cousin both went to very large churches, and you know, down in the South, you're talking about then a pretty big congregation when you get in one of these big churches. And I'm not trying to diminish anybody's religious practices, but both of them said to me, people are praying for me and this is going to get removed. And that story rings so, resonates with me so deep, because we ask you here to get out the pick and the shovel and get about the business of working the steps. Get about the business of getting in unity with the traditions, and get about the business of being in service like the concepts speak to, because we know that if we're going to be in harmony, we're going to be in participation. My mother's dead from drinking. She died at my age exactly now. I'm 58 years old. My mother died alone in an apartment drinking Listerine. My cousin died immediately after we had a meal together in 2004 on the 4th of July, and he was reporting to me, all these people are praying over me. I know this thing's going to get removed. The third step says you will become willing, and willingness requires of you action. So if you think we're all going to be about, you know, a guy said to me, I was in Oregon last weekend, and he said, well, can you go over again all that about the fourth and fifth step? And I said, no, but I'll tell you what, I'll talk to you privately about it after we get finished. But we're not going to spoon feed you. You got to go get after this. Get a sponsor, talk to them, get some direction, and start. I tell every woman and man I sponsor the same thing. Your fifth step's going to take all the time you procrastinate in one damn day. So start. Start. That's that's the kind of sponsorship I've had. Very little sort of sympathy and a lot of, kind of hard direction. That's okay with me. I have a sponsor now who's Jewish, born on Christmas. Anyway, I always call her with a Santa Claus hat on Christmas. And anyway, it's a little joke. So I'm as you can see, not a very linear speaker, but I'm back in Alabama now, if you can think about that. And I got two guys I'm running with. They're both my neighbors, okay? I grew up with them, Scott and Perry. And we're doing some more serious things, you know, criminal things. And my father said to me when I was about probably 17 or 18, you three are going to be in jail or dead before y'all are 21. With a great serious attitude, my father gave me this report. Both of these, thank you so much. Thanks, sir. I was going to sing, and that's why he brought me this water. I turned 21 in prison doing life with, you know, Merle Haggard. Merle Haggard. So my father said that to me, and the reason that is memorable is because both of those gentlemen are dead. Perry and Scott are both dead. Scott was a guy that I really, as my husband knows, I've talked about him often over the years, would call me from time to time, never could get sober. Tried to get in some different communities, never went to Alcoholics Anonymous, never went to Narcotics Anonymous, and died in 2014 on Christmas Eve. And Perry died about 10 years before him. After I got sober, I was with my father, and we were reviewing some documents. His second wife had died, and my father was looking at his estate planning, and there were some issues about my stepbrothers and sisters. I have two brothers and five stepbrothers and sisters. And my daddy said, hey, would you consider looking at this for me? And I said, well, of course I will. And I kept pulling up one after the other of these life insurance policies. And I said, doggone, you sure got a lot of life insurance, Daddy. And he said, well, actually, four of those policies are on your life. So my father really was convinced that my outcome was going to be a pretty short one. My life, my mortality table, as we say in the law, was not going to be what it usually is for a female. So he said, the good news is I didn't have to cash in on any of those. And anyway, we had a few good laughs about that. But back in high school, I finally graduated. And right after I did, I'd go up there to the Plush Horse. I don't know if anybody has ever been to the Plush Horse from around here. Anyway, it's in Huntsville in Madison County. And then, you know, disco was going on. Oh, she has. All right. Dewey Brazelton. Yeah. So I had a jumpsuit. You know what I'm talking about, baby. Anyway, I thought that was really classy. So I had a one-piece jumpsuit. Anyway, we'd get up there and dance. Disco was going on, but, you know, I was, uh, I, I was, uh, I danced to it, but I had a little bit different music taste. And the only thing about a jumpsuit is when you're wearing that and you've got to pull over down the highway, you have to really strip to urinate. So the whole thing comes off, and then anybody coming along in their car, you're a little bit, stunned because there's nothing you can do. So that's the downside. But anyway, I've been up to the plush horse with my buddy Jane, and Jane's a tough gal, and I love her so much. Richard and I just visited her in Metairie in New Orleans, around New Orleans. But anyway, Jane had been in a terrible car accident before she got in the car with me, and she had been in a full body cast, and then we would put people in plaster. You know, medical professionals would put people in plaster. So we'd have Jane in at a few events and parties, and she'd just have to stand up against the wall in her cast. And anyway, she'd gotten out of that damn cast, and she was in the car with me. And the critical fact about this story is we'd gotten out of Jane's Volkswagen Rabbit, and we'd gotten into my Pontiac Bonneville. Now, you know what a Bonneville is? I don't know if they make them. Yeah, anyway, I had a sweet ride, okay? I loved that car. It was green with gold top and gold interior. And so Jane and I had been drinking since 3 p.m., and now it was about 2 a.m. And we were on a rural road and going out to where she lived to meet up with some of our, low-class Confederates down there who were all stayed up all night, That's how I operated. If I got home in the morning, that was good news. So we had traveling, and we were on a very rural road, and a train came. I was driving and hit our car, and so we were pushed off the track into a ravine, and the windshield went through my throat, and Jane was eventually out of the car. We don't know if that was by trajectory because she's alive, but. Or she got out herself, and she had a severe head injury. And a woman on her way to a nursing job at the hospital was traveling this rural road. So the train never stopped, and he later said he knew that there was some kind of action, but he didn't know what had happened. The car was destroyed, and this woman found us, called the EMT team, and they took us to the hospital, and a man named Guy B. Wilder sewed my throat up. Some people who know me have seen my throat, but anyway, I had about 700 stitches in my throat, and my larynx was cut, and Jane was hospitalized, and I was in a coma. I didn't know what had happened. My father came to see me along with a gentleman who I'd been seeing in high school, and he was sick, physically sick, when he was looking at me. And I when I came to after a few days, I knew that something was severely wrong, but I didn't know what. And he, Tim finally gave me a few details, as did my father. I stayed in the hospital for a period of time, and I went into respiratory therapy because I had to have a lot of assistance in breathing. And before I was released from the hospital, I had people bringing me liquor. So hospitals then had less of the sort of oversight, like everything, than they do now. But I was drinking while I was hospitalized. And that is the kind of person that I was. That's how I saw the need. It was constant. And the other thing was, I never saw any nexus between that car accident and my drinking. Though it was just that I had a lot of a series of of unfortunate events. And there used to be a band called Spirit, and their song was, "There's a Black Cloud Following Me." And I don't know if you remember that band, some of you, but that's how I figured things were. So when I would sit in jail, I would think, things are going to be very hard. Life's going to be hard, and it's probably not going to be long, but I'm going to manage it. And so that kind of managerial spirit was always a part of my drinking. It was clear that my managerial oversight was a total failure, but I did not see the need to quit drinking. And you didn't have this kind of movement like you do now to kind of integrate young people with speed. So if you're young and in sobriety, this is what you don't have to live through. These are the things you don't have to do. You know, my father sat every Sunday. My mother was an evangelical Christian and my father was an Episcopalian. My father sat every Sunday in an aisle by my grandmother after she had died, where there was a beautiful window. What do you call the glass in the... stained glass window in memoriam to my grandmother. My daddy would sit there, and by him on the same aisle was Judge Straub. And Judge Straub was a guy who would sentence me. You know, I'd go up in front of him in arraignment in a bathing suit with a T-shirt that said, "Marijuana is nature's way of getting high." And on the back it would say, "Disco sucks." And that's the kind of degradation that my parents saw day after day after day, having a daughter like me and my younger brothers had to live with. Because I was, you know, I got around. I did not have a good reputation. And you got two young boys following you in school, and your sister's well known, and unfortunately, notoriously. So I was absolutely everything that a parent would never want to see in a child. And so as time passed, my father said, "Get out." I got out of the hospital, and by that time I'd been out of the house. After I was released from the hospital, I was already out of the house because my father had said, "You can't live here any longer." And we saw no hope of me going to a college education at that point in time. So I started working on a dairy farm. I don't know if anybody's ever done that work, the hardest I've ever engaged in. And when I was drinking, that kind of physical labor was really abhorrent to me. And I could barely carry the buckets of milk. You know, I'd carry them like this with both hands. We had to clean the dairy equipment with acidic solution. We had to bale hay. Anyway, I went back and begged my father, "Would you reconsider and allow me to go to Auburn University?" I went to Auburn, that was my idea, because a guy that I was seeing was in engineering school there. And so my father said, "Yes, I'll give you that chance." So I got down to Auburn, and things picked up like they always did. Number one, back then you could get a student loan directly sent to you. It did not go to pay your tuition. It went to you. This was the greatest financing scheme that I'd ever come up with. So I would get these student loans. I would enroll in school, and you know, I could get by in some of my classes. But then when you got to statistical analysis, and you were doing lysergic acid during the test, and the test was breathing, and I'd been drinking for 5 days, it's hard to kind of phony up your test results, you know. So I was rarely at school. I lived at 1313 A Opelika Highway. I know that because it was on a lot of search warrants. And it was down the street, way down a kind of a country road in Auburn. Now this is all, of course, developed, but undeveloped land. And I lived in a house owned by the Stars, and I was a renter. And so I lived there with Tim, the gentleman who's now an engineer for NASA. Great guy, superior guy. What he was doing with me is well beyond all our comprehensions. But he he and I would fight. You know how it goes when you're both in a relationship like I used to be in. And we would go down to Harry's, which was down the road, and drink, and they didn't have a closing time, and it was, you know, same operation like the River Club. And I'd leave, you know, I'd get mad at Tim, and there'd be some guy who'd been playing down the street in a band, and I'd go off with that guy for about 3 days and come back to our place, and Tim would pull him out of the car with a gun and hit him in the face and break his nose. And I mean, he didn't know that I was committed to somebody in a fidelity, or, you know, I didn't have any idea what that meant. No concept. When we talk about character defects in Alcoholics Anonymous, after I got sober, I was engaged to a man, and I was riding down the street, and he had given me a beautiful ring. This is not my husband, another gentleman. You know how it goes. We had met in AA. We'd gone to a few meetings together, and then they say, how do you know that people are dating in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because on their second date, there's a moving van in their driveway. So we had we'd moved in together. He'd asked me to marry him. This is, of course, not recommended, but I did all those things wrong in early sobriety. I worked in a bar, and I went to meetings, and I moved in with the guy that went to meetings with me. So, but I had a very strong desire to stay sober. So I had on this beautiful ring that he had given me, and I pulled up in my car. So this is, now I've kind of gone ahead, but I'm sober. And a guy's looking at that ring, a guy in the next car. And I thought like this, turn my ring around. You know why? Because I wasn't much, but I was always available. And that idea was one of those old ingrained ideas that I'm not committed. And everybody needs to know it. So I'm not going to let anyone know that I have a commitment to fidelity. And I remember calling my sponsor and us analyzing that situation. And she said, you're engaged. You may not get married, but today you're engaged. Start acting like it. That guy didn't know me from anybody. He probably was dating a smoking hot exotic dancer who he was going home to. But that idea in my mind, I'm always available. That's why we're talking about 6 and 7 with such vigor. You got to go excavate that stuff. You know, the other thing that I really believed in practice was, what's yours is ours, what's mine is mine. Okay? So when I was living with this guy in early sobriety, is that what y'all practice? So when I was living with this guy in early sobriety, I thought, you know, I'm in school. I'm struggling. He's got a good job. And my sponsor said, hey, you're not any kind of domestic servant. You can't cook. You're not raising his kids. Start ponying up your part. Start being self-supporting and act like it. Another old idea. Excavation work had to be done in 6 and 7. And part of that is surrender. Surrender in pieces. That's what happened to me. I surrendered in pieces. And those kind of operational details. My father will not be the person I go tap if I need something. I am self-supporting. I will be beholden to no one. And then we're talking about integrity, aren't we? When we look at the steps, we know that every step has a principle, don't we? And our character defects are the opposite. Step 1, honesty. Step 2 would be hope. Step 3, faith. 4, courage. 5, integrity. 6, willingness. 7, humility. 8, brotherly love. 9, great justice. 10, perseverance. Never in my catalog of attributes. Never. Perseverance. 11, spirituality. And 12, service. And so our character defects are when we're practicing the opposite of those. So that idea of transforming, again, happens in 6 and 7. But I'm going to jump back again to Auburn. So I'm living at Auburn, and I'm up to a lot, and none of it is legal. Okay, as I always say, I never paid taxes. Let's just put it that way. So I had a police officer who was fond of me. And he came by one day, and I wore my bathrobe a lot. Did you do that? Any of you? I didn't have time to get dressed, you know? Things were pressing. And so I would go to Harry's in my bathrobe and sit at the bar in my bathrobe. And the guy would let me, you know, in the morning, not in the evening, but in the morning, he didn't care. And so I was in my bathrobe, and Bart came in, and he said to my, you know, my hovel, and he said, "Edith, you know, we've been watching you now for a while." And he said, "Things are going to come down, they're going to come down, and they're going to be heavy. And if there's anything you can do to get some help, you need to do it." And I said, "Get out of my house. Get out of my house." He had extradited Scott, the man I told you about, one of my old running buddies. He'd extradited him back to Florida. And Scott was one of those guys. Do you ever have a guy like that who all the firsts with? You know, the first time you did this. That was Scott. I'd grown up with him. I had a great fondness for him. He was a lot of trouble just like me. And we came in and out like waves into each other's orbit, you know, from time to time. But he'd been in my house, and they'd extradited him back to Florida. And Bart had helped with that, this police officer. So he left, and you know how it goes with those guys. They come back, and they don't have to knock that time. On the second go-round, you know what I mean? They got a no-knock warrant, baby. And they serve it before daylight hours. Some of you may have had this experience. So they just come in, and they come in because they kick the door down. And it was my birthday. Not exactly. It was about 4 days after my birthday, but it was still my birthday to me. So my birthday lasted for a long time, and yours probably did too. And so I'd been drinking Jim Beam, my favorite. I always bought a quart of Jim Beam, and I loved it. It was cheap, not real cheap to me, but because I was poor, but it was relatively inexpensive, and it got the job done, and I loved it. Drank it straight, and had a Coca-Cola chaser. So I'd been drinking Jim Beam, and back in Omaha, I had an old friend, and guess what his name was? Jim Beam. And we'd stand at the corn. If you ever come to Omaha, we'd love to have you to the Cornhusker Roundup, which we have there. It's a pretty big deal. But Jim Beam and I would be at greeters together, and we'd both get squirt guns, and then we'd blast people as they come in, which was, of course, poorly received. But I didn't care. You know, that's what we're talking about in sobriety. Go have some fun, you know? Go do a few things poorly. I tell all the people I sponsor, fail at a few things. You're not going to get it all buttoned up into perfection. You know, I didn't do well every day in law school. I didn't have every answer. I've done my best at the practice of law. But things are messy. You know, I went to a big event when I was a bartender right after I got sober. And I had one good dress, my mother's silk dress, had a big stain on it. It's the only dress I owned. And I got off the bus to go to the big event, sober probably 6 months, and a rainstorm came. So I didn't have a driver's license, wasn't driving. I tried to drive, but my sponsor said, "You can't drive, you don't have a driver's license." So we asked that you act in an honest manner. Sober, and that means every day you don't angle shoot, you don't cut the edge off. So I got out, and the rain came down, and I went into this party soaking wet. And I remember thinking, I don't know how to operate here. I am not going to be a good visitor, and I don't have anything to say, and I don't know how to conduct myself sober. And I'm telling you, I'll never forget that day. And I walked into that huge restaurant where this big event was with many people who were in the hospitality industry. And there was a guy who went to one of my meetings. And he looked at me from all the way across. "How are you?" And he said, "You look beautiful." That's what he said to me with his lips. "You look beautiful." And that was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic from a long way across. I knew I looked like a dish rag, okay? But I knew there was somebody else there who was sober, and they were speaking the language of the heart. And there was going to be somebody at this event that I could go speak to. And that's what you should be doing. I won't tell you what to do. What I should be doing, every meeting I go to, is there somebody here who's absolutely shaken out and scared to death? Let me give them a hand. Let me give them a kind word. Let me stay out of the little group that I might operate in typically and look at every person who's new. You know, when I go to the penitentiary up there in Lincoln, Nebraska, they always say, "Edith, you want someone with you?" And I say, "No, I don't." You know why? I don't want a supervisory, a companion. I want to go out and shake it. It happens to be a men's penitentiary. I want to go out and shake every guy's hand. You know why? Because human touch. That's what a lot of people need. Human touch. The kindness of a word we may say. We don't know how that may turn someone that day, that moment. Be here now. Be here now. You know, mindfulness. Am I here? Am I right here, right now? So anyway, I'm going to now be back in Auburn. So you know, those guys come in, they kick the door down, and everybody's on the floor, and they got rifles to their head, because all my friends had been arrested before. They were felons. Not all of them, but many of them. And I thought the best idea I can come up with is to get out the back door. Okay? The problem is there was no back door, but there was a back window. Back window. Okay? So I saw that back window, and I had a young guy who was kind of hanging around with me, and he was back there in the bedroom with me, and I said, "We got to get out this back window." And I started, their long drop too, 15 feet. I was still willing to go for that. But I started climbing out the back window, and I could hear Bart. And he said, "Edith, get back in the house. We got the whole place surrounded. And get dressed." You know? So I went to jail again. And this time it was much more serious because they had searched my home and it was a lot to be found. So they, you know, consorted with me about some deals they wanted me to do and things. And I listened. I was, again, had been taking a few things, so it was hard to listen and pay attention to what was going on. But they released me because I was going to be, of assistance to them. And immediately upon my release, I left town. And if you're considering what you should do, if you need to turn yourself in, I'd recommend getting some advice, okay, before you make a decision. So I left town and I went out into a very rural community, a kind of a country community, and lived with some guys that I knew. And by this time, I was drinking all the time, and these guys were hillbillies, and they drank like I did. And I was bleeding. I had blood coming from different orifices. We'll just put it that way. It was troubling, but I didn't care. And I had concluded that maybe things were going to be short for me. And I was wanted. And I was known to be wanted because there was a statewide report. So they had done this raid in Auburn and done this raid in Tuscaloosa, and the people that were arrested were reported. So I was statewide news, and my parents knew about this. And I stayed out in this house with these cats for weeks, I don't know how long. And one day there was a knock on the door, and it was, I heard a guy say, "I'm here to get my daughter. My name is Shine Peebles, and I'm armed. My son's armed, and we're not here to cause you any trouble. I just want my daughter. If she's in there, send her out." Of course, these guys, being my strong allies, pushed me right out the door. But my father had paid people over weeks of time to find me in a old backwoods house, run-down house, and had brought ammunition and a gun, and my brother, also armed, to fetch me. Now, I don't know what you think about that scenario, but I can tell you, there's nobody who loved me as much as my old man did. And after I got sentenced, he took me in. My mother and father drugged me and took me to a mental hospital, so they couldn't serve a warrant on me until I'd had some chance for recovery. But of course, if you've ever been locked up in a mental hospital, a couple of things were memorable to me. One was that I didn't want to drop my anchor there because I didn't think that I had lost all hope. And number two is, if you have any sporting events while you're there, you better be willing to be very nimble, because when all your teammates on the volleyball team are on Haldol, there will be no volleying of the ball back. You know what I mean? So they'd volley the ball, and then I'd go get it. I'd go retrieve my own serve. You see what I'm saying? Anyway, I broke out of there lying to a psychiatrist like we all have been known to do. And finally they caught up with me, so I go to the trial probably a year and a half after I was arrested. Had an excellent lawyer, Joe Dean, still a friend of mine. I go see him when I'm in Auburn, or at least call him. Now I can go back to Lee County. I was not to ever return to there. But anyhow, I went to the trial. My father brought a man who had been to Korea with the judge. The judge just gave me a 5-year prison sentence in Juliet Tutwiler in Tuskegee, Alabama. And the judge went in, spoke to my lawyer, talked to this gentleman who'd been to Korea with her, and talked to the prosecuting attorney. And they said, if she leaves town and is in supervised living quarters, we'll suspend her sentence. We agreed to those terms, and I left. I left with my father saying to me, don't ever come back to our home. Don't call your mother, your grandmother, your great aunt, or your brothers, because I've done all I can. And I love you, but you've now been amputated, so you're not to have any contact with us ever again. And my father got in the car and drove away. And I knew he meant it, because he was good for the word. And I got on a plane with handcuffs and went to what I thought was Idaho, but it was actually Iowa. I lived up there in supervised living quarters. And, you know, when I got off paper, I'd been working for a guy, moved in with him. As I say often, I lived in, for a while before that, I lived in Section 8 housing. Had a guy bring me an air conditioner. I lived on the fourth floor of Section 8 housing, and it was hot, man, in the summer in Iowa. Brought me an air conditioner. I gave it up for an air conditioner. That's the kind of girl I was. I could not lower my standards fast enough to keep up with my behavior. So I'm speaking one time in South Carolina, and a guy said, well, did he at least install it? I went over to a bar near where, after I'd moved in with my boss, and I went over to a bar and started drinking again. And it was called the Dodge Inn. Thank you, Richard. My husband's here. The Dodge Inn. Went in there and started drinking again. And as you might think, Edith, did you ever get an idea about what had happened to you all these years? No. Never collapsed it into the idea of I was powerless over alcohol, my life was unmanageable. And I ended up in another bad car accident. And two EMT guys got me out of the car. And I was taken to the hospital. They took my blood. I was back in jail, usual place for me to be. And at the end of this story, a guy came to see me in jail and told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was released with a bracelet. And I started going to the 48th Street Club because my probation officer told me I had to, or I'd be returning to jail. And the 48th Street Club was a clubhouse that stayed open a lot of hours, maybe not 24, but a lot of hours. And a woman called me out there. I'd go into the meeting, sit in the back. She called me out and said, hey, come on up here, Ethel. I said, well, my name's not Ethel. But I walked to the front of the room and I said, my name's Edith. And I'm an alcoholic. And that was in 1987. And exactly before that moment in time, I'd been in a hospital because my esophagus was causing me a lot of trouble. And a doctor had said to me in Omaha, Nebraska, with all the clinical, zero frothy emotional appeal that the doctor's opinion talks about in our book, he said, "You're an alcoholic. You're not yet 30. And I can do nothing for you unless you quit drinking." He said, "I've read your records, the ones I could get. And I've also spoken to the other people who've been integrated with your care here. And you're an alcoholic." And that moment in time, both that arrest and this doctor speaking to me, were one of those intersections when divinity, as Bob said, providential circumstance happened to me. I was desperate, and there was a opportunity called Alcoholics Anonymous. And since that day, since that doc said that to me, I haven't had a drink. That was the 1st of June, 1987. And then I was going to these meetings, and I was talking about now I'm an alcoholic, reported that at the meeting, and had this sponsor who was a hard ass. And, you know how it goes. They say there's a school for hard-ass sponsors. Mine went to it. But anyway, she was a class gal. She's no longer my sponsor. She moved out of town, and I have a great debt of gratitude for to her. Her husband was a lawyer, and at this same time, I would see him quite often. And he said to me, "Hey, why don't you go up there and take that LSAT test?" And I said, "Well, let me give you a number of reasons." And I went over my arrest record. And anyway, I took the LSAT, and with really no preparation. I was still working in a bar, went and took the test, and you know, sent the results in to about three schools, thinking that I was an unlikely candidate, naturally. And the Creighton University accepted my application. And my application, I can tell you, was many, many pages because, you know, you have to disclose everything. And with Creighton University, where I happen to be in Omaha, Nebraska at this point in time, is full of Jesuits. And you know what? They're about second chances. And they gave me a ride. They gave me a roll. They didn't give me a ride financially, but they gave me, they rolled the dice on me. And so I went through law school, and when I finished, you take an exam, of course, as some of you may know. And I went to apply for the exam, and same thing, had a 37-page with all the addendums, every person I'd lived with, every arrest, the disposition of every arrest, on it. My brother, my kind brother, had gone to the bottom of Morgan County Courthouse, nothing digital back then, and excavated with one of my high school friends all of my records, had it all, presented it, and the Bar Commission said, "You will not sit for the exam. You are what we qualify as someone with moral turpitude, which means your character is such that we will not allow you to have a bar license." Now, if you want to talk about throwing some rocks at God, I was doing it. I was 70 G's in the hole. I'd been through three excruciating years of trying to understand how to be a good student, and I'd written onto the law review. I'd done all I could to be a superior student. I'd given the commencement address at my class's graduation. And my sponsor at the time said, "Is there an appeal process?" Well, I thought, she didn't go to law school, but I never thought of that. So I appealed. I was successful. I wrote in there everything that I would tell you tonight. You know, I was sponsored and had sponsees. I had been a treasurer, a general service representative. If you'll give me a chance to have a law license, I can tell you that I'll try to act every day with integrity and lose my ego. And that what I'll be about is being a professional with somebody that you can be proud of, and they gave me a chance. So I sat for that exam and passed it. That same year, I went before the Board of Pardons and Paroles in the state of Alabama and asked them if they would consider me for a pardon because I wanted to have the ability to vote. I wanted to be in community with my county, with my state, with my country. and have all the rights that were afforded to other people. And the Board of Pardons and Paroles accepted me for a pardon. Now, I don't have that pardon up in my law office, but I'm sure proud of it. And as time has passed, I've learned a lot of lessons. One of them is about ego. You know, you have my ego. I had a resentment against a guy for a good time. His wife was my client, and later his ex-wife. She was pretty well known in our community. And he would come and we've been in litigation now for over 13 years, many times, in front of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And I, when my father was dying in 2012, had missed something I was supposed to do. And because of that, my client had some bad consequences, and he pressed them. He pressed them to happen. And I became so angry at this guy that I grew to hate him. Hate him. Every time he'd call, I'd decide what I was going to do for his demise. I had my private investigator start considering him. Okay? And I was all about hate. And I was 25 years sober. And I could not let go of it. My husband knew about it. My sponsor knew about it. And I'm telling you, I kept walking down that road, stopping, almost failing to eat, because I was growing to such a fomenting of this event. And what happened was I got broken open because I knew I wasn't going to stay sober if I continued this. And I started praying for the guy. And you know what I'm talking about on 552. I prayed for his happiness, his prosperity, and his good health, just like the book told me to. Day and night, day and night. It ain't 2 weeks for me, baby. It's a year. Okay? And we're talking about praying for resentments. I'm not in for the 2 weeks. But day and night, day and night. And if I didn't do it in the daytime because I was in court, I'd pull over on the side of the road. If you have a resentment, says the book, and you want to be free of it, if you'll pray for the person or thing you resent, you will be free. If you ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, and their happiness, and you will be free. And even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, do it anyway. I was committed to that process. Why? Because it changes your perception. Why? Because it transforms you. That's what prayer and meditation do. You know, the Dalai Lama says, hang a lantern on it. Be a skeptic, be a doubter, hang a lantern on it. The Lakotas are who taught me how to pray. So I wasn't very good in conventional religion, and I started going to sweats. And I still have as a good friend one of the Lakotas who oversees the sweats, and I still go back. I also go with my husband to the Catholic Church where he's a deacon, and it's a privilege to be in both sides because I had to learn to be quiet, and I had to learn how to be out of myself and into a channel with something that's stronger than me. In 2012, let me go back to that. I got over it. That guy still, I'm still in litigation with this guy, and I'm telling you, my blood pressure doesn't rise when he calls. And my father was dying in 2012, and we brought him home, brought him back to his house. And I was staying about 10 days with him and 4 days back in Omaha working, and that went on, probably doing that shuttle from late 2011 until March or April of March of 2012. And it was such a privilege. I'd just sleep by my daddy every night on the floor. And he lost his ability to communicate. We took the dialysis off and got the guys to take him back to his home so he could die there. Every day I'm giving him morphine, and my brothers say, how did it happen that you were the one they trained to give our father morphine when you're the least likely candidate to be doing it? My brothers and I have a great difference of opinion, and I bring that to your attention because spiritually we have different kind of ideas. That's okay. But they had said to me, you and daddy are probably not going to see the other side of things. You're probably going to hell. And that's their belief system, and I respect it. But this day, I was tired and I was mad. And they came over to Daddy's, and we were in a row. And I thought, this is going to be a sad report, isn't it? the Peebles family out arguing as their father dies in the next room. The boys and the sister having a scuffle, like hillbillies out in the backyard. And one thing came to me. You are your father's eyes. You are your father's voice. You are your father's ears. My father was losing his senses as he was going over. And I'd been sleeping with him and tending to him day after day, in communion with him, without saying anything. And I knew right then that my old man had forgiven me for everything I'd ever done. He'd become one of my closest friends. We'd started traveling together, and I never missed coming back to Alabama 4 times every year since I got, when I could afford it, after I got the law practice. And my father had completely forgiven me. And I knew that if I was going to be about the business of asking for forgiveness, I better be about the business of forgiving. And at the end of that, my brothers and I all stood in community together at his funeral. And we've had a lot of times that we've still been at it. We've been in some even physical altercations, I hate to report to you. I didn't start them, and I back away now. But I'm not about being silent about things either. I think you have to bring your point to it. And maybe you can say, just like I do to Richard from time to time, you may be right. But I'm a girl who's gotten a lot more than she deserves. And, I was talking about having a good time, and I'm a scuba diver, and I've got a guy that races cars who I navigate for, and I've got a husband who's given me the opportunity to travel a lot of places. We're wanderers. We were in Antarctica not too long ago, and I was quite sick. I thought I was sturdy, and we were on a boat, and after you leave Ushuaia at the edge of Argentina, and you get into those waters around by the South Georgia Islands, the water, it's rough. And I was sick. And I thought a lot of people on the boat drinking, having a jolly time, and I thought I better get a meeting together. So I asked the French maitre d', would you consider putting up a notice of a meeting? And she agreed. So we put up the notice, and she said, there's one beautiful woman who is here, and she may come. She's called on me and said, get everything out, every bottle out of her accommodation. So I thought, that's my gal. So we go to the appointed time. I've got a garbage can on my side because I need it. And I've got my big book. And there's the woman shows up. My husband came with me too, even though he's not in Alcoholics Anonymous. He sat with me. And then a man shows up. And we have meetings in Antarctica. So I'm reporting to you, Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well, speaking the language of the heart, even in Antarctica. About 2 years ago, I was speaking in Missouri, and a woman came up to me, and it was a woman who'd been on the boat with us, and she was still sober. So I'm going to tell you thank you for having me, and close with one of my favorite readings of all time by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. From a book called The New Pair of Glasses. Get some new glasses. It's my business, excuse me, I love you. It's none of my business what you think about me. It's my business what I think of you. And I love you. If you happen to love me back, that's a real plus. So you can add to my life, but you can't take away from it. Did you hear me? This is one of the greatest things you've ever heard tell of. You can add to my life, but you cannot take away. And everybody that lives can add to my life, because I'm not trading with you. I love you, period. First, because you're a drunk. And second, because I know who you are, whether you do or not. You are a child of God. Every one of you, and for that reason, I love you, and for no other. Thank you for your consideration. Godspeed.